Today is Wednesday, September 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Coming up, another attack in Afghanistan, this time in the city of Jalalabad.
Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump has ordered more sanctions on Iran as Tehran continues to say it was not behind the Saudi oil field attacks.
And Israel's election remains too close to call. So what's next? Those stories and more coming up next.
A multi-pronged attack took place on the Afghanistan National Electronic ID Distribution Center in Jalalabad, the capital of Nangarhar Province. An explosion at the front gate of the compound cleared the way for multiple attackers to enter the compound Wednesday afternoon, according to a spokesman for the governor. Special forces surrounded the compound soon after, and fighting continued for some 4 hours. Authorities rescued about 12 employees, perhaps more, from the facility. An employee of the distribution center told VOA that he was wounded in the initial explosion, along with some other colleagues, and about 10 people were wounded in the attack, according to authorities. No group has claimed responsibility thus far. On Tuesday, two attacks, one on President Ashraf Ghani's election rally in Parwan and another at the Defense Ministry office in Kabul, killed at least 48 people. The Taliban claimed both attacks, warning of more to come, especially on election-related activities. Afghans will head to the polls September 28th to elect the next president. Earlier this month, negotiations between an American delegation and the Taliban that might have resulted in a reduction of violence in parts of the country were unexpectedly called off by U.S. President Donald Trump after a Taliban attack that left a U.S. soldier dead. Fighting has since intensified, and an attack on the country's electricity infrastructure has left Kabul and 10 other cities struggling to cope since Sunday.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is traveling to Saudi Arabia, where he is to hold talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of a response to the weekend attacks on major oil facilities in the kingdom. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia say Iran is responsible for the attacks, an accusation that Iran has denied. Barbara Slavin is the director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. She talks to me about the implications of Secretary Pompeo's visit to Saudi Arabia as tensions in the region grow.
So, Ms. Levin, Saudi Arabia says that it has evidence which it plans to release today linking Iran to the attack on its oil industry. Do you see this as them making a case for any potential retaliation?
Yes, I do, but I don't think they want military retaliation. I think they're perhaps looking for something else. It does seem as though Iran was involved in this attack, directly or indirectly. So I think we'll be looking forward to seeing this information that the Saudis have and, you know, seeing how trustworthy it is. I think we have to remember that the Saudi government has a bit of a credibility problem. Because of the incidents involving Jamal Khashoggi and its treatment of dissidents in general. We will see what this information is.
Now, France and Germany and some of the other countries in the region have not weighed in on who they think is responsible for the attacks. Do you think that this makes it difficult for the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to enlist support for any possible military response?
Yeah. Look, the problem is that this escalation all began after the United States decided that it wanted to try to prevent Iran from exporting any oil, essentially imposing a unilateral embargo on the sale of Iranian oil. So there isn't very much sympathy for the United States in the international community because of that. And there is a, you know, even though these attacks are terrible, there is a sense that that they were provoked by actions by the United States. And, of course, the Saudis have been cheering on the United States campaign against Iran and encouraged the United States to withdraw from the nuclear deal. So I think that's one of the problems in terms of mustering an international response to these attacks.
Now, Tehran says that any retaliation from its part to military attack will not be limited to its source. What do you think they mean by that?
Well, Iran is a very powerful country now. It has influence in a number of countries in the Middle East. It has partners from Lebanon to Yemen. And many of these forces are in close proximity to American forces in the region. So there has to be a tremendous effort to prevent this from escalating, because if it does, it could embroil really much of the Middle East.
Mm. And President Trump says that he has ordered new sanctions on Iran this morning. Do you feel like this will inflame further the tensions?
But actually, the reverse. I think it's a climb down from his threats. You know, remember, he said that the U.S. was locked and loaded for retaliation over these attacks. And so, you know, sanctions, I mean, that's what the U.S. does every week against Iran. I'm frankly curious to see what more there is left to sanction. I don't think there is very much. It just shows the bankruptcy of U.S. policy, frankly, because all of these sanctions have been piled on Iran in the supposed search for a new and better deal, and all they've done is increase tension.
That was Barbara Slavin, Director, Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Meanwhile, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, has been in Europe meeting with U.S. allies there. He spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb about the U.S. role in investigating the attack in Saudi Arabia.
United States Joint Command has sent technical experts to Saudi Arabia to assist them in the forensics of the attack. The president has made it clear he's not looking to go to war. Having said that, what we saw was an unacceptable act of aggression, and there's a number of ways to deal with that, and I'll leave it to the president to decide which way we pursue.
The spokesman for Yemeni Armed Forces, or Houthi military spokesperson, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, in a video statement in Yemen on Houthi-owned TV today, repeated claims that the Houthi attacked the Saudi oil fields despite U.S. claims that Iran is responsible for the strike.
Israelis' two main political parties remain deadlocked Wednesday after an unprecedented repeat election, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu facing an uphill battle to hold on to his job. Speaking in Hebrew, Benny Gantz, the leader of Israel's Blue and White Party, says according to the suggested results, Netanyahu did not succeed in his mission. While on the other hand, the Blue and White Party is a project established only 6 months ago and is a huge success and here to stay. Prime Minister Netanyahu made no victory claim or concession of defeat in a speech to his Likud party Wednesday, saying that he would await official results. Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, you know, the polls are saying the election is too close to call. This is a day after Israelis went to the polls. Where do things stand now?
Well, the latest, which is with about over 90% of the votes counted, says that the centrist Blue and White Party, which is headed by Benny Gantz, who is a former chief of staff, has slightly edged out Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, with 32 seats for Blue and White and 31 for Likud. But it doesn't really matter, because in Israel, it's really about the blocks. Who can get to the magic number of 61? In other words, a majority in the Israeli Knesset. And it looks like neither of them can.
So this is why Avigdor Lieberman is calling for a secular unity government between the two. But, I mean, we're talking one seat difference. I mean, how do both those parties come together to actually, you know, form a government?
Well, so it's called, as you said, a national unity government. And what it would do would be bring together those two larger parties and Avigdor Lieberman, who almost doubled his strength. He's really the kingmaker in all this, which is kind of interesting. His party, which is called Yisrael Beiteinu, or Israel is Our Home, is mostly of Russian immigrants. and they are staunchly secular and against the ultra-Orthodox, who have quite a bit of control over many Israelis' personal life. For example, Israel has no civil marriage. The only way to get married in Israel is through the ultra-Orthodox rabbinic authorities. The issue is more that Gantz, Benny Gantz, has said he will not sit in a government with Benjamin Netanyahu because Netanyahu is facing a series of corruption allegations. And Netanyahu has said that he will only step down if he's convicted, not if he's indicted. So the question then becomes, will Gantz compromise a little bit? Will Netanyahu step down as the head of the Likud and they will appoint somebody else, which I don't think is likely? Or will they continue kind of horse trading and trying to find some sort of compromise? Another possibility is a third round of elections. This was the second in 5 months. And I think the Israeli public is kind of fed up and does not want that. You know, I think that the majority of the Israeli public wants to see a national unity government. So there's going to be pressure on both sides to sort of compromise. You know, perhaps Netanyahu will say, well, if I'm indicted, you know, he has not yet been indicted. According to Israeli law, even if he is indicted, he could stay in power until he's actually convicted. There was concern among a lot of people in the public, well, how can he run the country, which is facing threats from Iran and from Gaza and from, you know, on all its fronts and from Hezbollah in the north and conduct a defense? Or, you know, Benny Gantz, who's really a newcomer to politics, might say, you know what, it's important to me to get political experience, to be part, you know, to be part of this. And so what the way this would conceivably work is called a rotation where, you know, Benny Gantz, since at least right now he has one more seat, would be the prime minister for the first 2 years, and then Netanyahu would be the prime minister for the next 2 years. And it's conceivable that in that time there would be a decision about the corruption allegations against Netanyahu. So there's all kinds of things are open still, and there's going to be a lot of political horse trading going on in the next few weeks.
Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And this is VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said the risk of a no-deal Brexit is very real, 2 days after his meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in Luxembourg. The alarm was echoed by Finnish Minister for European Affairs, Titti Tuppurainen.
The latest developments in Westminster and the call for a further extension make it very difficult to predict how things will unfold. We have to acknowledge that, currently, a no deal on 31st October is a quite likely outcome. Not at least because the UK government keeps on repeating they are ready to leave without a deal. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, preparedness efforts have to be stepped up and measures finalised quickly at the EU and national level.
The comments come from the EU as Britain's Supreme Court heard its second day of arguments for and against the government suspending Parliament. Now, to get all the latest Brexit details, I spoke with Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, I guess where I want to begin today is we're in day two of the Supreme Court testimony about whether or not it was legal for Boris Johnson to prorogue Parliament to suspend it. What can you tell us about the hearing today?
Today we heard from the government's own lawyers on the government's position that it believes it was a political decision to suspend or prorogue Parliament, and it's not the region, not the area of the courts to interfere in political life in the UK. So that's, if you like, the government's first line of defence against these court cases. They're simply saying that the actions of the government are independent from the courts and the courts should not interfere in political life. So we've had the government's lawyers arguing that point. We also heard subsequently from the other side, the case brought by a group of lawmakers, both in Scotland and England, and they argued that, in fact, the government was acting illegally, that the courts should step in, because, in effect, the Prime Minister acted unlawfully in advising the Queen to suspend Parliament. So this is what the case will turn on, whether the courts believe, whether those most senior judges will believe that they have a role to play in that decision. And that will be crucial as to decide whether they can then say that the Prime Minister did act illegally and that Parliament should reopen again.
That's taking place in Britain, but across the water in Brussels, the European Parliament voted today to offer Britain an extension. It's a non-binding resolution, but what, if anything, that will that have on the talks that seem to have gone nowhere when Prime Minister Boris Johnson met with Jean-Claude Juncker in Luxembourg only a couple of days ago?
It is only advisory, as you say, but it is important because it does indicate that the European Parliament does have an appetite for that extension, and for any extension and for any deal to pass the European Union side, it does have to be approved by the European Parliament. So a significant intervention in that it just does underline the point that the deadline is approaching very quickly. Britain is running out of options, and if Boris Johnson or whoever might be in power upon that deadline on October 31st does go to Brussels, it seems to be that Europe would be open to offering an extension. And that's by no means a given, because there are other powers within Europe, particularly, for example, the French government, who say they've had enough of Britain coming back every few months without making any progress, without offering anything new, and just asking for an extension of a few months and then Britain going back into some kind of political chaos. So while the European Parliament has indicated that it's an important step, I think it's very important as well to watch other significant players on the continent to see what appetite they have, or whether they might turn the screw and say to Britain, no, this is it, it's October the 31st, either change your mind and don't leave, or you're leaving on that date.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
The United Nations is urgently appealing for $52 million to provide life-saving assistance to thousands of the most vulnerable people in eastern Ukraine to prepare for the harsh winter months ahead. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Winter temperatures in Ukraine can dip between 15 and 20 degrees Celsius below zero. The UN reports the situation for thousands of people in the eastern breakaway region of Ukraine is critical and will get worse as winter sets in a couple of months. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, reports nearly 60% of the families living within 5 kilometers of the contact line are most vulnerable. This patch of land divides Ukraine between the government and Russian-backed separatist-controlled areas in the east. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says people living along the eastern side of this line have difficulty accessing essential services and humanitarian workers have difficulty providing for their needs. He says people in eastern Ukraine are aware of the situation and are doing their best to prepare for winter.
One elderly woman told our staff in Ukraine recently that, and I quote, "Summer is usually a time when one should enjoy time outside, but for me it is a time when I must start saving from my meager pension, cutting my health and food expenses to be able to save up for coal for the winter." That's the situation for millions of people.
War in eastern Ukraine broke out in April 2014. The UN reports more than 13,000 people have been killed, including one quarter civilians, and more than 30,000 wounded. Though active fighting has diminished, the simmering conflict continues to disrupt daily life for millions. Laerke says families along the contact line cannot access health care. He says part of funding from the appeal will provide 80,000 people access to health care through a mobile medical team or will pay transport costs for them to access other facilities. He says money will be used to repair houses damaged by the conflict, to winterize shelters so they can withstand the winter cold, to provide cash for people so they can buy coal for heating and pay for food so people can stock up before prices increase as winter approaches. Laerke says $16 million also is needed to protect people from mines and other explosives along the contact line. He says about 2 million people live in these high-risk weapons-contaminated areas. The UN reports Ukraine is the third most mine-affected country in the world after Afghanistan and Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An annual fireworks display in Hong Kong, marking China's National Day on October 1st, was called off Wednesday as pro-democracy protests show no sign of ending. The city issued a terse statement saying the show over its famed Victoria Harbor had been canceled in view of the latest situation and having regard to public safety. Major protests are expected on October 1st, which will be the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party-governed People's Republic of China. Beijing warned the United States not to get involved the day after a group of activists, including former student leader Joshua Wong and Hong Kong pop singer Denise Ho, appealed to Washington to support their fight. Chairman of the Congressional Executive Committee on China, Congressman Jim McGovern, explained why they were invited.
We stand in solidarity with the protesters, you know, who are demanding that their rights be protected, that they have a say in their future. Over a million people have taken to the streets in Hong Kong. I don't think we've ever seen protests as large as this and as sustained as this. And they're fighting, for a cause that we share, the right to determine their future. I've been inspired by the protest movement, and their demands, I think, are reasonable. Any rational person would think that they're reasonable. We wanted to hear how we could be helpful in terms of paving the way for them to determine their own future. So that's why we held the hearing.
A new virtual reality experience from Stanford allows patients and families to travel inside a human heart before surgery. Jenna Mitchell takes a look.
Bo, I, and his 12-year-old son, Orion, know almost everything about the human heart. Orion was born with a congenital heart defect and is about to undergo his fourth open heart surgery.
My son has a heart, who's born with a heart defect. We knew prenatally about it through a series of tests.
Today, however, is the first day the father and son are going to see the heart in virtual reality.
All right.
Thanks to a new virtual reality experience called the Stanford Virtual Heart, created by cardiologists at Stanford and Lighthouse Inc., a VR company, which allows users to explore a computer-generated heart that shows defects in 360 degrees while wearing a VR headset.
What have you been doing this? Are we still doing Viola?
Dr. David Axelrod has been treating Orion since birth. He's also the lead medical advisor for the Stanford Virtual Heart. He said the project was originally created for medical students, but he says it's also beneficial in helping some children and their families better understand complicated procedures.
We've been able to use it with selected groups of kids to help to explain some of the congenital heart defects and the surgeries that our team performs here at Stanford.
You can spin it around, you can kind of look at the back. You can grab the different heart pieces, and you can kind of look at it, and it's moving and beating, and you can kind of see how the blood goes around, too.
It was pretty amazing, actually, to be able to look, especially the inside of the heart. It really allowed me to visualize, like, all the stuff that Orion's been through.
No. No, okay, I turned the volume.
For children and their families facing cardiac surgery, the Stanford Virtual Heart can bring better understanding and maybe even some comfort. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Palo Alto, California.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, for Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.